welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world accessing the show on the internet. Our studio guest this week is Richard Graves, nephew and biographer of First World War poet Robert Graves.
Alatia Page brings you a report from the Bristol Gaza Link launch at the Council House in Bristol. There's also a feature on Bernard Smythe, a reporter at the Bristol Evening Post from the 1950s to the 1980s, and who eventually ended up with a plum job as sub-editor on the Daily Mirror in London. Malcolm Greaves is here again to read another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire in the 1820s. Jeff Sparks is away this week, but he is back again with us next week.
I'm Lisa Braden.
And I'm John Peters Colvin, presenters of this week's show.
Welcome now to Richard Graves, nephew and biographer of the poet Robert Graves, probably best known for his poems written during the First World War.
There's a rose that grows in no man's land, and it's wonderful to see. Though it's great with tears, it will live for years in my garden of memory. It's the one red rose the soldier knows. It's the work of the master's hand. Mid the war's great test stands the Red Cross nurse. She's the rose of no man's land.
Well, welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
Let's talk about poetry.
Certainly.
You're the nephew and biographer of Robert Graves.
I am indeed, yes. People often think, because it's now the 21st century, they often think that perhaps he was my grandfather or great-uncle, but actually he was my uncle. He was born in 1895. His youngest brother was my father, John Graves, born in 1903. And I got to know Robert, first of all, when I was up at Oxford in the 60s, because I overlapped with him. I was up studying history at St John's College while he was the professor of poetry for a few years, and we just overlapped by 2 or 3 years. So I got to know him quite well then, and then I used to go out to visit him in his island home in the northwest corner of Majorca, or Majorca, as we used to call it in those days.
So tell me about his poetry.
Well, he was a poet from a very early age. He was writing rhymes when he was 5 or 6. And he started writing poetry seriously when he was at school at Charterhouse. And when he was about 15, he was being very, very badly bullied. And he found that writing poetry not only gave him a small circle of friends, but also was a relief from the frightful torments to which he was being subjected. And so from then on, he said that poetry was his absolute ruling passion. He then continued to write poetry, and he certainly wrote it during the... at the time that he left Charterhouse, it was just a month or two before the First World War broke out in August 1914. And although he had been an absolute pacifist up to that moment, he was so outraged by the German violation of Belgian neutrality that he signed up as quickly as he could and went off to Wrexham to join the Royal Welsh Fusiliers.
And tell me about the poetry that you like of his.
Well, you were talking about the First World War poetry. In fact, that was the poetry he himself liked least. And in his later collected works, he tended to admit it. But he wrote some very good, rather powerful verses during the First World War. I'm rather fonder of some of his later verse, which he wrote when he was living out in Majorca. And he had developed a theory by then about the fact that every poet has to be inspired by a muse. This led him into a lot of difficulty in his private life, as he was always falling in love with people to whom he wasn't married. But it certainly gave him quite an interesting time. And some of the love poems he wrote are, I think, his finest work.
Do you have any of his poems with you?
I've got extracts from one or two of his war poems here. Would you like me to read one of those?
Yes, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Well, here's one of his. It's called The Morning Before Battle, and it runs, "Today, the fight. My end is very soon, and sealed the warrant limiting my hours. I knew it walking yesterday at noon down a deserted garden full of flowers. Carelessly sang, pinned roses on my breast, reached for a cherry bunch, and then death blew through the garden from the north and east and blighted every beauty with chill breath. I looked, and my wraith before me stood, his head all battered in by violent blows. The fruit between my lips to clotted blood was transubstantiate, and the pale rose smelt sickly till it seemed through a swift tear flood that dead men blossomed in the garden close." That was a poem he wrote fairly early in the war, at a time when he had, in fact, just become friendly with another war poet, Siegfried Sassoon, who thought that poetry of that sort he described as very bad, violent and repulsive.
Siegfried Sassoon was quite very cynical, wasn't he, in his poetry, and quite sarcastic.
Well, he developed a very sort of ironic trait, and he became quite cynical about the course of the war later on. When he first went out to the war, he was full of idealism, and he wrote a poem to Victory before he had even been on the front line, which begins, "Return to greet me, colours that were my joy, not in the woeful crimson of men slain, but shining as a garden, come with the streaming banners of dawn and sundown after rain." And it goes on in that sort of vein and is very, very idealistic. But he thought that was the kind of poetry one should be writing about the war. But once he had actually had some experience of the trenches, he did then change his mind quite considerably.
Would you like to talk about that?
Sassoon was one. Well, let's just put it another way. I think that Sassoon was certainly a very interesting war poet. And when he had decided that the war was actually a thoroughly bad idea, he became quite a pacifist. And although he was incredibly brave and was actually awarded the MC, and he did the most incredible things. And we all have seen films about the First World War. We all know what it was like. The two sides basically dug trenches from the sort of the northwest of France right down to the southeast of France. And they sat in these trenches, sometimes only 30 or 40 yards from each other, and bombed each other and shelled each other, and then occasionally decided to try to advance a few feet and got out of their trenches and stormed forwards and were cut down in large numbers. So it was a war which was appallingly wasteful of human life. And Sassoon, there was one occasion when, amazingly, he single-handedly walked forward with a few bombs, little hand bombs, and drove a whole lot of Germans out of the trench opposite, just single-handed. Absolutely quite incredible.
Oh, wow.
A feat of just massive bravery, and he was awarded the MC for that. But, as I say, he began to feel that it was just a terrible waste of life and was utterly wrong. And at one time, back in England, he circulated his views and said that at one time he had thought the war was a wonderful enterprise, but now he felt that it was just being pursued for the wrong reason and that certain people were just doing it to make money out of it and all this kind of thing. And, of course, that was treasonable in those days, and he could easily have been put in front of a firing squad. But my Uncle Robert was one of the people who persuaded him that this wasn't a terribly good idea to put this point of view forward so forcefully. and he was put in front of a medical board, and they agreed that Sassoon had actually had a sort of breakdown and gone mad, and that was a much kinder thing, because otherwise Sassoon would undoubtedly have been executed for treason. As it was, he was sent off north to Scotland to a place called Craig Lockhart, where a Captain W.H. Rivers, who was a psychologist there, was in charge. And Sassoon then had a very interesting time, because while he was at Craig Lockhart, he met another poet, even less well known than Sassoon was in those days, called Wilfred Owen.
Oh, I love Wilfred Owen.
Well, the interest, again, thinking about people's reputations, at the end of the Great War, which finished in 1918, at the end of that war, Rupert Brooke was famous as the poet of the Great War, and there were various other people who were extremely well known. Wilfred Owen himself had only had four poems published in an extremely obscure journal and was virtually unknown. But now, all this time afterwards, most of the other poets of the First World War are relatively unknown, but Wilfred Owen stands out as the outstanding poet of the Great War. And if you're talking, say, to a sixth form today, I always know if I'm giving a lecture to a sixth form, the safest thing to do is to end with a few of Owen's poems, because it doesn't matter whether people have liked or not liked any of the earlier things. But when you get on to Wilfred Owen, Owen still speaks to them directly and clearly, and they respond to that. And of course, Owen was first really made famous when nine of his poems were set to music in Benjamin Britten's War Requiem in 1962 or 63. And it wasn't until then that he was really generally well known. And now, of course, he's absolutely famous. Shall I read one of Owen's poems?
Yes, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Well, I think I've got one here somewhere. You can hear lots of paper being shuffled in the background as I search frantically. This is a very well-known one, Anthem for Doomed Youth. Mm. And this was a poem which Owen was having long conversations up at Craig Lockhart with Sassoon about the futility of the war. They agreed, they said, all a poet can do today is to warn. Owen began to understand that in war and the pity of war, he had found his subject, and Sassoon was very helpful to him with revisions. This is a poem which Sassoon said, that's an anthem. And Owen said, just what I meant it to be, calling it Anthem for Dead Youth. Then Sassoon said, well, dead isn't a wonderful word. How about doomed? That's much more powerful. So we now have this poem, Anthem for Doomed Youth, which runs, what passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries for them from prayers or bells, not any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill demented choirs of wailing shells, and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmers of goodbyes. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers, the tenderness of silent minds, and each slow dusk a drawing down of blinds.
How does that poem make you feel?
I think Owen's poetry does make one feel terribly sad about the waste of war. He has other poems in which he describes people who've been badly wounded. For example, there's one poem in which he describes somebody who, as a young man, was a great footballer, used to be cheered by people when he had scored a goal, and was very excited when the war broke out and dashes off to the front and thinks it's all going to be wonderful, and then is very badly wounded, comes back home and finds that nobody really cares about him anymore. So Owen's poetry is about the pity of war and how it devastated people's lives. He wasn't a pacifist. He was a great Christian, and He said, you know, how can one be a Christian and think that war of any kind is realistic, which is also interesting because then that brings up various moral dilemmas. Is there such a thing, as, for example, as a just war? But we could talk all evening about all these poets, and they're all absolutely fascinating. And I hope that in this conversation I've interested some of your listeners in the poetry of Owen, Sassoon and Graves.
So tell me about your book, your biography.
Oh, my biography of Robert. That was a real labour of love. That's 10 years' work, 3 volumes, a kind of insane 19th century venture. It all began because when my father died, he had left behind him some work for a book he was planning to write called My Brother Robert. And as a kind of pious duty after his death, I thought it would be nice to put this in order and get it published. But then, as I looked through all the family papers he had amassed, I realised that I actually had the material which would enable me, for the first time, to tell the difference between fact and fiction in his famous autobiography, Goodbye to All That. And so what started as a duty of tidying up my father's work, which I thought would take 7 or 8 months, ended up in 10 years' work, writing 3 volumes about him.
So how does that make you feel, having spent that much time writing about it?
Well, it's curious. It's something I never intended to do, but I'm very proud of it because I feel it's one of the few things I've done which will probably last indefinitely. And the reason is this, that putting Robert's war poetry to one side, Robert wrote a most remarkable book called The White Goddess, which tells you everything about being a romantic poet. And because romantic poetry appears to be a part of every culture in the world, that book of his will go on being translated into modern English in centuries to come. And of course, my biography will, I hope, coast along on its coattails.
Thank you very much, Richard, for coming along today. So, Richard Graves, nephew and biographer of the poet Robert Graves, thank you very much for coming along this evening.
A great pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our next item is from Dialects reporter Anthea Page. It's an interview with Steve Lennock at the trade union rally at Tolpanel this year. Steve is chair of the agricultural section of Unite, the union, and here he talks about key issues in his speech to trade union members. We apologise for the wind background noise in this interview.
My name is Steve Lennock. I'm the chair of the agricultural sector of Unite, the union.
And can you tell us a bit about things you said in your speech just now? It's very windy down here, isn't it?
It is very windy, but at least it's dry. In my speech, I spoke about the solidarity that farm workers enjoy with other trade unionists across the country. As an agricultural trade union, we are quite a small group of membership, but we know that we enjoy the support of the wider trade union movement, and you know, I come here to thank them for that.
Could you tell us about the deaths? That was quite worrying.
Well, there are an average of 50 fatalities a year on farms, ranging from children right through to pensioners. The 50 fatalities, almost one a week, and you know that is a trend that is not going down. It has been a trend over the last 10 years.
Why is that?
Because, well, farms are dangerous workplaces in as much as there's a lot of large moving equipment and combine harvesters and so on, very dangerous equipment, and because of the nature of the workplace being a sort of an open, unstructured workplace, it is very difficult to control the access of members of public, and also at busy times, workers may be, you know, taking risks through tiredness and long hours, or just cutting corners through poor training and so on. So there are lots of reasons why it is a very dangerous industry, and you know, it is something that needs to be addressed. The health and safety visits on a farm are perhaps one every 10 years. The health and safety executive is such a small body of inspectors.
What else did you mention in your speech?
I spoke about the international perspective for agricultural workers, where workers in places like Colombia, Iraq, Iran, trade unionists in those countries often face persecution and death and things like that. The very workers that produce the bananas and so on that go on into the supermarkets in this country often face persecution, almost sanctioned by the very people who sell the bananas on. Trade unions are seen in those countries, and the right for rights for workers are seen as something to be frowned on and avoided.
What about migrant workers?
Migrant workers, there are perhaps 100,000 migrant workers coming to this country each year to harvest the crops. They come to pick they start by picking the daffodils in the southwest, and they move through as other crops become available, through the strawberries, the soft fruits, then the black currants and so on, right through to harvesting the vegetables from the fields. They form the core of a lot of the workforce in the fields, and often they come in and are exploited on minimum wages with stoppages which amount to almost a bondage of labour. I can explain that a little more. Often migrants are housed 6 or 10 to a house and find themselves having to pay £30 or £40 each for that privilege. And per week, and they also have to pay exorbitant amounts for things like travel to work, and they end up at the end of the week with very little to live on, and certainly nothing to save and go home with.
So it's just exploitation.
It is pure exploitation in many cases. Yes, not all.
Yeah.
Not all agency workers are exploited, but an awful lot. And the Gangmasters Licensing Authority, when they discover these exploitations, take action and take the licences away from the people who employ these unfortunate workers, and fine them heavily.
Do you think the public could do more, like asking supermarkets where they get their strawberries from, and are they getting them from companies that exploit people?
I think the power of the supermarkets is very much a driver in this. The supermarkets talk about being ethical, but a lot of the produce they produce is picked by migrant labour under those conditions, and the supermarkets, if you like, turn a blind eye to the fact until it is clearly highlighted to them. They always plead ignorance, but the reality is that those same supermarkets drive down the end cost to the producer of that end price to the producer of that produce, and are almost complicit in the exploitation.
What else did you mention in your speech?
Well, I talked about some of the recent union successes, the Lindsay oil workers who were the oil refinery workers who came out on strike because some of their comrades lost their jobs and were not given a chance to take on further employment on the oil refinery site, whilst the company actively sought to engage workers from another country. We have nothing against employing workers from other countries, I must stress that. This is not about migrant workers as such and being opposed to them. It is the fact that we expect equality, and we expect equality of both opportunity and terms and conditions on any site.
So are there many young people going into the agricultural industry or not?
No, the agricultural industry at the moment enjoys an average worker age of something like 55. I have to say I'm actually about 55, and I appear to be the average age of a farm worker at this point in time. Low wages and long hours are not an attractive proposition to young workers coming into the industry.
How can you attract young people to the countryside?
Well, you have to recognise that to live in the countryside is an expensive thing to aspire to anyway. And if farmers are only prepared to pay low wages for workers, the reality is that young people just aren't able to afford to move into places like Tolpuddle, for instance, rent a cottage and work in agriculture.
So what's the solution?
The solution has to be to improve the wages for farm workers. This year we've just finished the pay negotiation, and in fact, despite the industry not being in recession and actually doing quite well, we were only able to succeed in getting a further 2.2% increase in wages. Now that might sound quite good in the current climate, but agriculture isn't in recession, and 2.2% of peanuts is still peanuts.
So how do the farmers get labourers then if no one wants to do it?
Again, migrant workers are filling the gaps, often on lower terms and conditions than would be offered to a full-time worker, and it's also casualisation. Workers come in for specific periods and then leave again. The core labour force in agriculture is relatively small these days, probably around 35 to 40,000 full-time workers. And certainly there are lots of opportunities there, and you know, given the upturn in agriculture, we believe that things have to change, otherwise you know, farming will find itself in a real muddle.
That was Anthea Page talking to Steve Lennock, Chair of the Agricultural Sector of Unite the Union, at the trade union rally at Tolpuddle.
This week, a meeting was held at Bristol City Council House to launch the town twinning link between Bristol and Gaza City. Our reporter Anthea Page was there, and she recorded these four interviews with some of the supporters of Gaza and the West Bank. But first, let's hear a Palestinian song from the Red Notes Choir, who performed at the launch, and this tune is called Biladi.
My name's Harvey.
Can you tell us why you're at the Bristol Gaza Link meeting this evening?
Because I feel it's a very worthwhile, necessary course of support.
And what's your background?
My background? Well, if you mean what do I do for a living? And I've been a nurse, I've been a motorcycle mechanic. But I don't think backgrounds really matter. This is a humanitarian crisis and we should all be involved. I was involved in the decommissioning of an arms factory in Brighton early this year, in January this year. And that was because of Israel waging its assault on Gaza. And we know that the arms factory in question, EDO-ITT, make bomb release mechanisms, which are then shipped out to Israel via the USA, but they end up in Israel, and they're used by the S-16s to bomb civilians.
In Gaza?
In Gaza, they bomb. I mean, I've seen the doctor's reports. Doctors completely neutral, and they're doing their report. And they're saying at first there was maybe odd policemen being brought into the hospital. But as the assault continued, more and more civilians were coming in, more and more children, you know, children and women. Why are they attacking them on mass numbers? It's that Gaza is like an open prison. It's wide in. People have nowhere to run. Even when they sought sanctuary in the United Nations compound, they were still targeted. That's why this cause needs to be supported.
What do you think the world should be doing about it? You're doing your little action in Brighton, but what should the world be doing, the politicians?
Well, everyone should be doing stuff. I mean, I imagine we're not going to see our local MPs here, like Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP. She's now a whip. She's unlikely to be here, even though she claims to support the Palestinian cause. I don't actually believe it. I don't see evidence of it. She's probably down in Brighton this week, where they're having a party conference. Who have they invited? I've heard that tomorrow they're going to get, what's his name, Edmund Barak, the Israeli Defence Minister, I believe, to join them down at the Labour Party conference. Now, he should be tried for international war crimes, along with the other Israeli hierarchy, and yet they're entertaining him. So I would call for the whole country to do whatever they can to support the Palestinians, and at the moment, particularly the Gazans, who haven't even got the materials to rebuild their houses. They're camping on rubble.
So what about the other parties, the Conservatives and the Liberals? Do you think they'll be here this evening?
Oh, we'll wait and see, but I can't imagine it, no. I mean, we shouldn't have to go and break up Arms Factory and stand before a jury in a Crown Court to explain ourselves. Our leaders, as they want to be, they should be stopping these atrocities by use of legislation, by the use of the powers that we invest in them. We shouldn't leave it to a guy like me with a hammer to have to deal with these things. It's a joke.
My name is Jennifer Oldershaw. I'm coordinator of Friends of Sabeel UK, and we work to support Sabeel in Jerusalem, which is an ecumenical liberation theology centre founded by Palestinian Christians in 1994. It is interfaith as well as ecumenical, grassroots, working for justice and peace in Israel and Palestine by non-violent means. Our role at Friends of Sabeel and Friends of Sabeel around the world is to inform people outside who know so little about it, to tell them what is happening and how they can help to raise awareness in the international community of what's happening. So helping to support the Palestinians in their struggle. One of the ways we help in particular is to go and visit, because it shows the Palestinians that they're not forgotten. They often feel very isolated. They think the outside world has forgotten them. So by going to visit, it shows solidarity with them, and they really appreciate visits from people like us.
How difficult is it to go into Gaza?
I haven't actually been to Gaza. That is how difficult it is. It's almost impossible now, and it wasn't very easy before.
Does the organisation take supplies in for people, medical supplies?
No, we don't. We support really by informing people, by raising awareness, by telling people the truth of what is happening.
How do you do that?
We have our own newsletter, and Sabeel Jerusalem has its own newsletter called Cornerstone. So those come out once a quarter. And we also have books and other publications which we sell. We've got some here this evening.
Is it mainly run by volunteers then?
I'm a volunteer myself. We have one paid member of staff.
And how many people in England or Great Britain are part of this organisation?
About 650.
And do you think more people would join if they knew?
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure they would.
So what's your website?
www.friendsofsabeel.org.uk.
My name is Shakir Yildirim.
Can you tell us about your trip to Gaza and the organisation you went with?
Well, we started off a Turkish community here. We bought the ambulance, and so I was going to go with Viva Palestina, so I was late. I set off on my own, so I went on my own to as far as Turkey. I just met and had a group of people, nine vehicles, going over to Gaza. I met them in the middle of nowhere at 3 o'clock in the morning when they parked up and sleep. I was tired. So coincidence has happened. And so they were too slow for me, so I carried on going. And when I finally got stuck in Egypt, say 2 days later they turned up, and we joined together. And I had a lot of serious questioning by Egyptian security services, or secret services. And 2 days later they allowed me to go with them in the end. So we got to Gaza without no problems. I just went in, spent 5 days there. So after 5 days, got back. But what I've seen is there, so it made me go back again with the, this time, articulated lorry. So we are fundraising for, we've got the articulated lorry, but we need a trailer and equipment and donations for people of Gaza, especially for children, you know, in need.
If anyone's out there and wants to help, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can get in touch through Bristol Gaza Link, the website. If they Google it, they'll probably come up with it.
Can you just tell us of the shocking things you saw? Is it too difficult?
Well, it is too difficult, so that's why I'm going back and trying to help them again with the equipment they need. I've seen loads of people with no arms and no legs, kids with no father, no families, you know, rumbled houses, mosques. I don't know, it's too difficult to say, really.
Too much.
So we don't know how lucky we are here.
Yes, I'm Pauline from South East London, and we have a friendship link with Beit Farik, which is an agricultural village near Nablus, about 7 kilometres from Nablus in Palestine, West Bank of Palestine.
Can you tell us what your organisation does?
Well, we are involved in exchange visits, and we also work with the Camden Aberdees Friendship Association. And we have sponsor Palestinian people to come over in southeast London. We're linked with an agriculture area. We sponsored Fuad Hanini to come. The community chose him to come, and he came to us, and we took him to farms here in Kent, and we took him to an agricultural college where he spoke to the students. We took him to packing stations. He saw produce being packaged, and these are the things the community wanted him to do when he was here, and he took back a lot of very useful knowledge. Also, it was very useful for our community because he spoke at public meetings about the occupation, how it affects agriculture, how the checkpoints makes it very difficult to transport goods, and of course we all eat food, so agriculture is very important.
You started off in a very small way and it's grown into a big organisation. Can you tell us how that happened?
There are now over 40 twin links across Britain, and they've all started in different ways. Ours started because I went to a film show and there were some leaflets, Aberdeen leaflets, and they were going to help rebuild an eye clinic which had been demolished by the Israelis. So I thought this would be a good thing to do. So I got in touch with KEDFA and I went over to Aberdeen, and while I was there, the message came from Beit Farik, our village now, from somebody called Marina, and she said, could somebody go to make a link with Beit Farik, because they felt completely lost to the world. These are the exact words that were used. Without hope, the village was surrounded with settlements. A man had been murdered by settlers coming down when they were olive picking. There were incursions by Israeli soldiers and tanks, and they felt that they needed to tell their stories, and they were totally isolated. So I went down, and it was the most amazing journey, because I took my Western mind with me, and when they said a taxi would be turning up at Aberdeen at 8:30 to take me to Beit Farik, I had this vision in southeast London of getting a taxi, and of course it was nothing like that at all. I'd went through all these horrendous checkpoints, produce was rotting at the checkpoints, young lads were made to sit down, people were harassed, women and children were there for hours on end, there were no facilities, no way to go to the toilet. So when I got to Beit Fariq, all the community leaders were there to meet me, and we had a lovely meal together, and they were just so pleased to see me and the joy of having somebody from the outside world. So I went back to South East London after that visit and talked to other people about the stories they'd told me. We formed a small group. We are a small group. So now we involve ourselves. I'm going over to Palestine again at the end of October on an EU partially funded project called Stories Our Mothers Told Us. And this is going to be a women's visit. 12 women are going from Britain, from different twinning links in Britain. We're going to be visiting prisons, children's centres right across the West Bank. We're going to be doing something very unusual. We're going to be working with Palestinian women. We're going to have partners, and we're going to be working with them at what they are doing. We're going to be olive picking, we're going to be cooking, we're going to be embroidering, then at the end of it we're going to Al Quds University, where we're going to write up the stories and the histories, and we're going to, this will be the Palestinians' histories and stories. Then next March, those women, Palestinian women, are going to come here as part of this project, and they're going to be doing what we are doing, our everyday lives, and we're going to be writing up the stories here. And through this, we will begin to discover our similarities and differences, because obviously the Palestinian experience with the occupation is something that we haven't, not all of us have experienced except during our visits. However, the diversity in Britain is such that they will be meeting people who have had experiences that mirror some of their experiences. They have had loss and dislocation. They have become from war-torn zones. They have had difficulty settling down in host communities. So we think that this project will, how we haven't decided yet, we're discussing how we're going to record it, it will actually be a window on the world of international friendship, of how much we share as women, no matter how horrendous our circumstances, the joys we share and the sorrows we share, which bring us together in our similarities and the differences from our particular circumstances and situations. So we think this will be a very wonderful project.
Now, that last speaker was Pauline Collins from Camden Abidis Friendship Association and Dar Asker Dakwa. Forgive the pronunciation if I have this wrong, though. Abidis Palestine, and you can access them on the website at www.camdenabidis.net or email them on contacts@camdenabidis.net. Just to spell that out, that's Camden, as in the place in London, CamdenAbudis. CamdenAbidis.net or email contacts@CamdenAbidis.net.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve, a story set in Oxfordshire between 1820 and 1830. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote us about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Never Volunteer pub in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Kind young lady. A sweet little totty. Totsum Jetsum sent for me to see me. She'd already made her way into the kitchen passage. How do you do, Mr. Fothergill? I'm so interested in your place. Oh, that's very kind of you. Now, I want to see more of it and have a good look round upstairs. The rooms are engaged. And if they weren't, one could hardly make a museum of the place. And where'd you come from? From Maidenhead just now. Ah, Maidenhead. By this time I had led her back quickly into the hall to be confronted by her undesirable man and another couple. Ah, Mr. Fothergill, do you know Mr. X? No, I don't. Oh, then you know Mr. Y? Yes, I did. But I thought I'd seen you at the Café Royal. Well, I haven't been there for 20 years. And so I shuffled off. This is not funny. But it's hard to have to do it, especially when everything else has gone wrong and 17 people have lunched when 78 lunched this time last year. Brothers Sitwell dine, two ordinary stalwart kind fellows, and so unlike their works, which I haven't read. About the most cheerful sight we've had here are the Jackson twins. The Oxford one brought his Cambridge brother tonight for dinner with Roberts, all from Rugby. They're both at physics, and at first sight they're excitable, fidgety, feminine ways make them look half-witted, until you realise the reverse. Vivian Jackson has just published a discovery of a nucleus that revolves, which he says has been accepted and much appreciated by the Dutch. Why the Dutch? I don't know. And no mean discovery, I should think, since no one has yet seen even the nucleus which does not revolve. The other, Derek, I overheard at dinner reply to a question whether he liked better Dickens or Thackeray. I've only read a novel by Dickens, so naturally I prefer Thackeray. Larrabee told me about the twins, which are, like the Jacksons, split eggs, and always the same sex. He said the best analogy in animal life was the armadillo, who has either 1, 2, 4, 6, or 8 young, which being of one egg, are always of the same sex, i.e. all little boys or all little girls. One of a party from Ascot, possibly a Spaniard, asked for claret cup, as she said she'd had it for the first time in the races. I said I didn't think ours would resemble too closely the Ascot claret cup. When they said how good and different it was, I replied, well, you see, it wasn't I who stole the Ascot cup. Such silly patter is good enough vehicle for showing people that they are nice and that you like them. How else would you show it? Kind Spurway. As I went into the little dining room, I saw at the table by the window one of three undergraduates, flopping over the arm of his chair with his head pointing downwards near the ground, and soup just served to them. I asked one of the others to take him out at once. They were silent and immobile, and I recognised in one of them a fellow I'd had an altercation with before. Having no effect upon them, I had their soup taken away and their table cleared, before which they continued to sit, whilst others were eating, looking, perhaps, feeling rather silly, and yet no response. Then, to my grateful relief, a soft voice came from another table. M. Spurway's, semi-hearty, semi-sentimentalist. Oh, Mr. Fothergill, do you want any help? So we gently lifted the huge fellow, who had brought his drink here inside him, which I believe is not public house etiquette. Hence, the alacrity with which a publican complies with the law in declining to serve a man who comes in drunk from the opposite pub, and hesitates to comply when he has made him drunk himself, out of the window, into the yard, and pushed him into their car, under the protest of the characterless youth who really seemed to think they were still wanted on the estate. Memory plays tricks. Such cruel tricks. Miss Dale brought to dinner Mrs. Dr. Carew Hunt, whom I hadn't seen for some years. I pointed out to her an uncommon purple penstemon on the table, and having momentarily forgotten that it was her late husband, the most courteous man alive, that had given it to me, and yet being certain that she was in some way connected with it, I risked, "That's the penstemon your dear old parson friend gave me." Then instantly knew what I'd done. We all felt a bit shaken. Later, when I came up with an attempted excuse, I knocked her glass of champagne all over the table. I'm sure they did their best to forgive me. The Brintons. Mrs. Rathbone, mother of the rowing blue, cheerful and talkative, is always bringing decent people here to tea. Today she introduced an apparently modest gentleman and fine-looking wife, as Mr. and Mrs. Brinton. I said to him, I know two Brintons, Selwyn Brinton, who writes about art, and Brinton, the Kidderminster carpet maker. Yes, those are my brother and cousin. And who are you? Oh, I'm nothing. Then, in an undertone, I've only been a master at Eton for 25 years. That's a good one for you, Hubert, says Mrs. Brinton. His daughter is still more lovely. Hubert Brinton told me how he took it down in a notebook at the time, how the verger was escorting a party round Westminster Abbey, when one of the party knelt down and prayed. Come along, sir, commanded the verger. But mayn't I have a few moments of private devotion? No, we can't have that, or we should soon have people praying all over the place. Liqueurs and bitters as beverages. 8 people, including 2 boys and 2 babies at breast, escaped in here to lunch today, Sunday. Halfway through, the man called out, Here, Governor, we'll have a bottle of Chartreuse. 1 bowl's enough. These 4 are children. But you don't want that. It's a strong liqueur. Then the woman prompted him, You mean Saltern. Years ago, on a cold, lonely Monday, at lunchtime, Katie came and said, A young man wants 2 glasses of Angostura. She had already tried to dissuade him, nor when she went in again with my message would he be dissuaded. So I told her to give it them, enough to poison the town with. Soon I went in to see this hero, a lad with his girl. He had to admit that the girl didn't like hers, and that he'd put his own into his coffee. Then he climbed down from his grand position, taken up for the benefit of his girl, and told me that some years ago a friend had taken him to a London club, and he could have sworn until now that the drink he had been given was called Angostura. But, he asked, grasping at a straw, was it white Angostura? Of course, I said, throwing him a rope. That's the mistake people are always making. And he breathed again. But they'd had enough liqueur for the day, so there was no need to invent one.
Thank you very much to the honeyed tones of Malcolm as ever, and you can hear another instalment next week. Jeff is away this week. In Jeff's place, we have another feature from Tony Gosling. Bernard Smythe worked on Bristol's newspapers as a reporter and then a sub-editor until the 1980s, when he was headhunted to work on the Daily Mirror in Fleet Street. He has seen some incredible changes in technology over the years, and when Dialect's Tony Gosling met him recently, he explained how journalists and compositors used to make up pages we read in our daily newspapers together without the interference by an editor.
We still wrote stories out or typed stories out on bits of copy paper which were cut out of the ends of reels of newspaper, and we would send the stuff down in a chute to the composing room where it would be set on linotype machines, which set one line at a time. And this lot was put together in eventually into what's called a form, which was a big steel case, which was the same size as 2 pages of a newspaper. And there wasn't time to make ink impressions or paper impressions of these pages, so if you're in a hurry on an evening paper, this is where reading the type in the form, which is left, you know, it's printed, it's the wrong way around, so that when it's printed on paper, it's the right way around. So you learn this technique of reading the stuff the wrong way around, and you stood at one side of the there was this union division where you were a journalist. This side of the these forms were on wheeled trolleys, so they could be moved about and impressions taken from this type. And the other side of the form, this trolley, was a compositor who was putting the stuff in the page, and he's relying on you to, if it was too long, to cut it in. And they were very skilled guys, and the trick was to be friends with them and get on with them. And I was quite happy to do that because I got respect for people who got skills.
So how did it work? Was there sort of the NUJ working with the printing union? Is it the NGA or something? I'm not absolutely sure what those unions were in those days.
Yes, there was the National Graphical Association, the NGA. We didn't work closely in the sense of union members. In fact, there was a lot of... there was an occasion where really the unions fell out because the printers weren't prepared to back the journalists. So I suppose they felt that the journalists wouldn't back them, and when it came to Wapping and the changes there, they were proved to be right. I went off from... Well, there's a big gap here. I last mentioned Birmingham, where I stayed only about 10 months because I was sort of headhunted to go to London to work on the Daily Sketch as a sub. And before long, I was working on the Daily Mirror, which was then quite a very good paper.
Why do you say that? Why was the Daily Mirror a good paper?
Well, it tackled all sorts of issues, which newspapers seem to have given up on, most of them. It would actually tackle issues of the day, and it had a couple of pages called The World Spotlight, which had news from every corner of the world. It was quite a serious paper in its own way, and I was quite proud to work for it. And again, I was headhunted. I did enjoy the work there very much. I mean, the strange thing was, talking about technology, at the Daily Mirror, we wrote every story out by hand. We would be given reams of paperwork. You know, it'd be stories from local correspondents, there'd be press association copy, local freelancers copy. We would be given all this stuff, and we'd have to read it all and distill it into, you know, maybe at the most 15 paragraphs. And every word of that we'd write out by hand, which would be taken down, maybe if it was late, bit at a time, down to the, or sent down to the composing room to be set into hot metal again.
Bernard Smythe there, and you can hear more from Bernard and other Bristol journalists. Just search on the net for the NUJ Oral History Project. NUJ referring to the National Union of Journalists.
The Red Notes Choir called O Freedom. Well, that's the end of another week's dialect show. Studio guest this week was Richard Graves. The Innkeeper's Diary was read by Malcolm Greaves. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Studio engineer was Mark Condon. Assistant engineer was Johnny Royden. The producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from me, Lisa Braden, and from me and John Peters Coleman, presenters of this week's Dialect Radio.